You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Tonight's episode, Enter the 36 Chambers of Colin Barrett.
This episode is sponsored by Harvest. I use Harvest for all my client invoicing. I was using the other guys, let's call them Simple Cooks. I found them usable, but not great. I moved to Harvest and they imported all my clients, my billings, my invoices, just everything. Harvest was so easy to use. You can bill through PayPal, you can do a credit card, you can do a lot more. Other payment gateways work just fine. Harvest also integrates with Basecamp, although I don't know why you would, HiRise, ditto, and even QuickBooks, if you're still using it. If you do any client billing, time tracking, or invoicing, you should get Harvest now. And just for you guys, if you use the code SCRUFFY, you get a 30-day free trial and then 50% off of your first month. GetHarvest.com. Check it out.
So this evening we have with us the lovely and talented independent developer Colin Barrett. How's it going?
It's going real good.
Excellent. So we all saw Dark Knight. That was pretty incredible. I actually had a really good time with
it. And you've ruined it for us now.
Yes. Well, because Bane and Sean Connery.
Now we've ruined it for everyone, which is what we should do.
Our job here is done.
Has pointed out that Bane sounds like someone doing a Sean Connery.
Sounds an awful lot like this.
It's true. And now you won't be able to hear anything else.
Yep.
It really is. I mean,
I'm wondering how much they ADR'd it, though, or even if it was his voice.
That's a good question. If it was actually Tom Hardy's voice. I mean, obviously it was significantly edited in post.
Right.
Oh, yeah. They did a pass on the voice before. People didn't like it. And then they came up with the current voice. But I'm pretty sure it's him.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool. I wondered if they got a voice actor to do it instead.
Bit of trivia. In the first Star Wars movie, Luke's aunt.
Oh, Aunt Beru, yes.
Aunt Beru, yeah, Aunt Beru. Her voice is actually not her. It's not the actress who played her. They replaced her voice with somebody else's.
Really? Huh. I did not know that.
Yeah, they just didn't, for whatever reason, Lucas and the producer, Gary Kurtz, I guess, didn't care for it. So they got someone else to ADR the lines.
Wow. I love the fact that we've got a developer on the show and we're talking about post-production. This is fantastic.
We're right in Star Wars, right off the bat.
Ken Bell is screaming and kicking.
That's my strike zone. You know, that's my wheelhouse.
Good times.
I don't know Ken.
Ken is was on our show once. He's a really good fellow. He's creator of The Dog Files, which is a show that airs on the internet. He does a lot of it himself. Yeah. All about doggies and cool stuff that doggies do and their owners and such.
Yeah, his, check it out. It's a really good show.
Yeah, it's really well done. And yeah, I think you'll dig it. So definitely. Dark Knight was absolutely fantastic. Although I had to pee about 20 minutes in, and a 2 hour and 45 minute film, that weighs on you.
Oh, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, that's a long, it's a long wait.
Yeah, I cameled. And because I didn't know if there was anything in the credit sequence, I stayed through the entire thing, just in case. So
I stayed, but I was pretty I had already looked it up and it said there was anything about halfway through. So
usually DC doesn't have after-show stuff, whereas it seems the Marvel stuff always has it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wasn't surprised that
I think the Marvel, DC like, stuff. That's part of their – Marvel's more aggressively going for the, like, sort of – all of the Marvel films sort of take place within, you know, a continuity and are kind of related to each other. And, like, they really built up the Avengers as very much a, you know, like, sort of like, you kind of wanted it to watch all the other movies previous to it to really get it.
Right.
Which I thought was an interesting strategy. It's very what you might expect a comic book publisher to do when coming into the movie industry. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like, a crossover, right? It's like all the crossover, other crossover exactly. comic books, right? You know, it's a single universe. And, for example, theoretically, you could have Superman and Batman meet up or what have you.
Right.
But we probably won't see that in the DC films. But
unless it was a film specifically where that was the premise. You know what I mean? And
then
like someone else as Batman and Superman for that movie. You know what I mean?
Right. They're talking about a Justice League movie. So that would be the case for that.
Who would be the characters in the Justice League?
Wonder Woman, Batman, Superman. Those are the ones that come to mind immediately that you got to have.
Aquaman.
and the rest.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if they'll have Martian Manhunter, for example.
Well, you know, that's funny that you mentioned that. There's been a rumor that they want to do a Martian Manhunter movie.
I think I'm the only one in the universe that would see that. I would like to see a Martian Manhunter film and a Vision film. Because I don't think that everyone knows Superman, everyone knows Batman. But once you get into the other esoteric stuff, it's not... Yeah. Like, I can't imagine that the... Because the budget for that sort of thing would have to be in the, you know, well over $100 million. And I don't see the audience... Right. Kicking in for that.
Yeah. You know, funny that the topic of comics comes up because I've actually just started watching the 90s animated Spider-Man cartoon on Netflix.
Oh, right. Not the Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends. That was
from the 80s. This is just Spider-Man. It's really good, actually. Like, it really holds up. Good.
Yeah.
It's really, like, they do really good, concise, tight, faithful tellings of the Spider-Man, like, villains and all stuff. Like, their Venom arc is really good, way better than Spider-Man 3.
Oh, wow. Well, that's not saying much, unfortunately, but yes.
Right, yeah. But I mean, you know, they hit all the right, you know, all the notes you need to hit with all these things, you know, Doc Connors and, like, I mean, they really build up to these. And, you know, they had Eddie Brock on the show, like, as a recurring character before the Venom things, and they, you know, sort of just showing, you know, oh man, you know, Peter Parker's, you know, screwing him over and everything like that. Yeah, they're doing a really good job with it. Like, I mean, still in season one, so.
Yeah, because they have all of the episodes on Netflix, and I wound up watching quite a few of them in some, you know, like you do, you go into a Netflix binge where you you hit play, and then you hit the next one, and then the next one, and the next one. And then six hours later, not only are you fused to your chair, but you've wasted 6 hours watching cartoons on your computer. In some ways, it's not so bad. In others, it's deeply, deeply shameful.
They're weird. Like, I grew up in Hawaii. Growing up there was really cool. It was, as a 17-year-old kid, though, I was like, man, this is so small. And, like, you know, it's so far away from everything. Fuck this place. Like, you know, and then I, you know, after leaving, and then it was like, wow, actually, that was pretty cool. Like, what was I thinking? Yeah. So, you know.
Well, I think it's one of those things where, like, everyone appreciates it once you've grown up, all those raging hormones and such, you know, the chemistry changes are all always going to spoil something that's actually really, really amazing. I actually grew up in East Asia, born in Korea and lived in Japan and lived in Hong Kong, then moved to London, then moved to the United States. And you know, in doing so, yeah,
I mean, just, man.
Yeah, actually kind of when you think about it, and it's like all these different cultures growing up, being exposed to all this stuff. And all I remember when I was younger is being really kind of isolated and really rebelling against my parents and really, really liking video games and befriending actually a lot of kids who were my age who barely spoke English. And I, you know, depending on where I was, I barely spoke Korean or barely spoke Japanese, but we had a common thread, which was video games.
That's awesome.
And we just hang out.
Sweet.
And we just hang out at the arcade and our skills were good enough that we would, you know, it wasn't like a complete trouncing. You know, one of us would beat the other and then the next game, the reverse would happen. Right. And this is, you know, this is early. Keep in mind, this is like early, 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 right? So it's, we had, you know, games like Pole Position and Pong. Pac-Man, Space Invaders, you know, all the like the ultimate
Galaga.
Classics. Yeah, Galaga came a little bit later, but certainly that was certainly one of them.
Were you in Seoul or?
Yes, I was. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I really want to visit Korea. It seems awesome.
When you were in Hawaii, were you able to travel to East Asia?
No, actually. And this is kind of an interesting segue into sort of one of the other things we want to talk about, which is music.
Sure.
When I was in high school, I was in my high school's orchestra, and I was in the top level orchestra. We had five. So my junior year, I was second chair of the first violin section. So,
oh, you play violin? You know, oh, wild.
Yeah, cool. I play violin as well. So
I played viola and cello. So no viola jokes, please. They're too easy.
I have so many.
I know. I'm aware of all of them.
We were getting ready, and I was helping plan this trip that we were doing for not helping plan, but I was, you know, I was at the front of the section, so I was expected to do a little bit more than other people. Anyway, we were going to go to China. We had this crazy, awesome itinerary, and we were going to do all this great stuff. We were going to have a concert on the Great Wall. We were going to, like, play with all these, like, Chinese conservatory orchestras. Like, it was going to be, like, a month bombing around China, like, just being super awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, it was going to be so cool. It was like no other – every like 2 years, there would be a class trip for one of the band or orchestra or whatever programs. Ours was like by far the most expansive and like craziest that they'd ever done. Like what the 1 year previous to that had been like the concert band had gone to Carnegie Hall and had played there and then gone to New York and like done stuff with Juilliard and then come home. Like it was like a week. Ours was going to be like 3 weeks. They canceled it because of the Iraq War and SARS.
Oh no.
Yeah, because it was gonna be like March 2003 was when we were gonna go, like over spring break.
Right.
Like, that was like right when like the yellow cake stuff was happening and like everything was like melting down with Iraq and we were like invading and like SARS was like just getting really bad. So they canceled all school trips and it was crazy. We were so disappointed.
Oh no. And there's no way to make that up to you.
No.
I mean, that's not possible.
Yeah, exactly. And I like dropped out of the orchestra program after that because I also really didn't like my orchestra teacher. The woman who taught the four levels below that was awesome and I really liked her. But like the woman who did the top level, like I didn't like her and my parents didn't like her. And like it was not working out. And since I was, at the front of the section, like, I had to interact with her a lot because, we would like do like fingerings and bowings and stuff like that. And
not fun.
Yeah, it was not fun.
One of the reasons why I was interested in having you on was that you are an independent software developer, primarily on the Mac. So how did you come about doing that? How did you find that?
More talk about high school. In high school, I got involved with the Adium project, which is Adium is an open source IM client for the Mac. Adium is very cool. And I got involved in that in high school. So this is about probably 2002 when I started working on it. I had known the guy who wrote, who at the time was the primary developer, just like because I was a user of the app and like not a whole lot of other people were using it. So I was just, I emailed with him and chatted with him on IM and stuff like that. And then when he was starting work on a rewrite and he like was like, hey, you want to help out? Like, and I was like, okay, I don't know. I think I was in 10th grade. So I wasn't like an expert or anything like that, but I knew a little bit about programming. Mm-hmm. Like I made like websites and like I had done some HyperCard.
Right on.
When I was in elementary school and middle school. So, I was like, okay, how hard can this be? So, I started learning and it was harder than I expected. And I took some classes in high school as well. We were lucky enough to have an AP computer science program, which was great.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I actually was able to take it before they switched to Java from C++. So I actually learned C and C++ and all that stuff in high school in a classroom environment, which was awesome. By the time college rolled around, I'd already been working on this for a year, Adium stuff for like a year and a half, 2 years. And so I was getting pretty good for a 18-year-old. So I had a summer job doing like Perl for this like web design agency in Hawaii. And then when I was in college, before I dropped out, I had this like part-time job doing PHP for some other web design agency. And then I dropped out of college, ended up working on Firefox at Mozilla. And I kind of got into that because of my open source experience on Adium. And they were like, we're looking for Mac people. And, we saw that you have an open source background and do this Mac stuff. And we'd like to talk to you. And so, I ended up talking with them and joined up there. And that was a lot of fun. It was a cool place to work. And then after the iPhone came out, I kind of moved on from there because I was like, I really wanted to get into mobile development and like, that just seemed like so cool. So yeah, I worked at Yahoo for a little while doing mobile stuff. And then after that, I've basically been on my own since summer of 2008.
So when did you get into iOS development?
When I started working at Yahoo, it was a mobile position. And it was interesting because the three guys who I was directly working with there were all ex-Apple, and they were they had moved over from the iPod group, and they were working on native iOS apps sort of before really the SDK had dropped. Just sort of like they had sort of sniffed the wind and found out, not found out, but they were like, yeah, there's probably going to be a native SDK. So they sort of like moved over to Yahoo to try and bolster their smartphone mobile strategy. That was really fun because like the first 2 months that I worked there, I actually did jailbreak development, and
that's cool.
it was really interesting because I'm like, I'm kind of a nerd about like low level stuff. So it was cool to see like how that worked and like, you know, getting the GCC tool chain all set up and everything like that. And then we had, the other thing that was crazy was we had nothing in the way of tools, literally nothing to do any debugging. There was no debugger, first of all. So to do debugging, you had to do like, you know, printfs, logs, right. But there was no like log file that you could like easily like dump or like read or way to do that. So what we had to do was SSH into the phone and then tail-f this log file that we would then write to from the program with log statements, like log, whatever. Yeah. So it was truly some like embedded system shit.
That
like,
is crazy town.
Yeah, it was really fun. And like the people that I worked with there were just really top notch. Carl Adam and Todd Ditchendorf. Todd is the guy who makes Fake App and Shapes App.
Do you like working on other people's projects or do you like working on your own projects more?
There's pros and cons to sort of to both, right? When you're working on someone else's stuff, some of the hard parts about a project you can kind of like sort of outsource to them, right? Like making decisions a lot of the time, you can just sort of say,
right.
You can just say, yep, look, it's your app and it's not mine. You know, you have to pick, you know. It's easy for me to sort of at that point, like just sort of distance myself from it. I've given my opinion, but then I'm going to sort of do what the plan is. And especially as a freelancer, because you take on so many projects, it's easy to just say like, okay, well, if this one sucks, like it'll be over soon and I'll be on to the next thing. Whereas when you're like at a full-time gig, you're like, well, I'm supposed to be here for the foreseeable future. And if it affects you more.
Right. That's kind of similarly to how I view it, because I've been in agencies most of my professional career, and including my own, right? And it's kind of difficult because when you're dealing with an agency situation, when you've got clients, the thing that you're making isn't really yours, right? So you've got, you know, n number of weeks to create this thing, and you're going to bang it out as well as you can, but there are going to be some decisions that the client clearly made against your better judgment,
right.
Which is always kind of a bone of contention, right?
But why are you paying me if you're not going to listen to what I have to say?
Right, which is, you know, it's understandable, you know, yeah. they are the client, and there are also a lot of things in play that you may not necessarily be privy to. The end result, the answer to the problem may be greater than you realize. And so I always try to keep that in the back of my head versus like, they just don't like the color green.
Right. But you don't know about the horrible green soup incident last week, you know.
Exactly. But if you don't, you know, you give it away. You give up this thing that you worked really, really hard on. It's no longer, you know, it was never really yours to begin with. But now this thing that you've been very intimate with, and you know, you've created from airy nothing, is now you're giving it away, and you will never see it again. Very rarely do clients come back and say, "Yeah, that thing that you did. Yeah, we want to keep updating this ad infinitum." Versus if it's yours, it's kind of your baby, which is great because you get to nurture it and watch it grow and have it become something larger than what it originally was.
Yeah, right. And the trick, though, is that it's hard to get that same urgency and rush. You know what I mean? Like, that's one of the attractions I find of doing freelance and agency work is that you get into a rhythm, right? Because you're always trying to, like, move quickly and, like, get stuff done for people. Whereas when you're doing your own stuff, it's sort of like it's the opposite, right? You have all the time in the world. It's really easy to get stuck on something. You're like, for example, one of the side projects that I've been fiddling around with, one of the things I want to do with it involves doing a ton of cylindrical computation, like date math. I find this stuff really interesting. Learning how to do it correctly is really hard.
That's why you have libraries to do that for you.
Right. Yeah. But even just learning how to use the libraries correctly to perform accurate, you know, semantically meaningful computations is still really tough.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, these Apple themselves mess this up somewhat frequently. You know, all those DST bugs on the phone, like that's, because,
oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's because people weren't using, you know, NSDate components or whatever correctly.
So even if the libraries are available, if you're not using them properly, you can still get bitten in the ass.
Right. And, like, you know, it's always also not always obvious how to use the library in the way that it's supposed to be used to accomplish what you want safely. Calendars are very tricky because they're very human.
Right. There's leap years and there's things that we change about calendars that you can't factor.
Right. And especially if you're dealing with non-Gregorian calendars, like, dear God. one of my favorites is the Japanese calendar, actually, where It is otherwise identical to the Gregorian calendar, except that the way years are counted is totally different. When a year begins when the new emperor ascends the throne.
Right.
Even if this is in the middle of a existing year. So you could like, and this actually happened when the Heisei era began, which I believe is the current era that they're in. It was like January 4th when the last emperor died. And then this new guy came up on January 5th.
Nice.
And a totally, you know, like, so there was no rest of that year. It was like, you know, the 60th year. Yeah, it was just 4 days and there's no January 5th or October 31st or whatever. Consequently, you know, the first year of this new one, the guy had, you know, he had a full year aside from the first 3 days of January, which, you know, it's just, what if your code expects that a year is, you know, roughly 365 days or, you know what I mean? Like, it's going to fail if the user is using a Japanese language, you know, using the Japanese calendar to count stuff.
There's a solution to that. Mm. Only use a Gregorian calendar.
People will not use your app if it doesn't use their date formats, it turns out.
Basically, Christopher's answer is give up.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Martha's hard. Let's go shopping.
It's certainly an option.
There's also the idea that the Gregorian calendar is an internationally recognized date system. And it's not just necessarily US-centric, most of the world-centric, especially if you want to get anything done via any of the global monetary systems.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But I mean, if the app you're working on is not, it is more, you know, in this case, it's more focused on personal use rather than like business or collaboration right. sort of thing.
Then you want to be, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you want to be
users,
personal.
You know, the way the user encounters dates and times, right? That's, mm-hmm. you know, because it was more familiar to them.
Sure.
Yeah, so.
So you need a big button on it. Like when if the emperor dies, they need to push this big red button right quick so it resets.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, exactly.
In case of emperor death, push button.
Push this, everything goes back to all balls.
It's like, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I was just talking about that today on Twitter.
Yes, you were.
Yeah, really. So in PostgreSQL, the SQL database, there is a string magic value. Used for like various things like, you know, now or yesterday or tomorrow or whatever that will give you the right time, you know, when it's entered. So you can do, you know, you can say query blog entries or whatever you're storing your database from yesterday or whatever. But one of them is one of them is all balls. That's one of the magic values.
Like you do.
All balls. And it's midnight UTC. Which, and then, you know, I was like, what the hell? Why is that in there? And someone explained on Twitter that it's like, you know, it's zero. The balls are all zeros. And it's, you know, it's like a JPL slang from like the 60s or like NASA stuff.
It actually comes from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah. And those guys did a lot of LSD.
Yes, they did. And so I think the best reply to that entire thread was, I was expecting it to be all eights.
Yeah, yes. It was like you got to file a bug that was like, why isn't it all eights? Which is just perfect.
So the big news of the day, which by the time that this actually airs will be the ancient news of yesteryear, was, you know, the Sparrow acquisition. So the big news is that Sparrow, the iOS and macOS Gmail client, which was pretty good. You know, I paid for it. I really like it. It's got some quirks. It's got some things I don't particularly like about it, but I liked it well enough that it became my de facto mail client, as much as you can have a de facto mail client other than the bundled mail app in iOS, was acquired by Google for a lot of cash. And
Google is not planning to update it.
At all. It is completely end of life. And the irony is that I went to check my updates and there was an update for Sparrow. The saddest update ever.
The update to change the updater, not to check again.
Right, yes. Oh, the saddest.
I actually found that really interesting because it's sort of like the Twitter discussion about that was really good, like especially like with Daniel and Manton, who had a lot to say about that. And I feel like it's somewhat unusual for a company pretty, you know, they were about as close to the definition of, at least when they started, of the traditional Mac independent software developers you can get, right? Two guys, totally self-funded, bootstrapped, made this cool app that was a passion project of theirs.
That was a weird thing though, right? Because they started out that way and then they started getting VC funding.
And they hired a bunch of people and they started to become not Sparrow the app, but Sparrow the company. You know, they were working on a Windows version and an iPad version. It was strange.
Right. Usually what happens when someone, you know, one of two things happens. Either you get Sherlocked, which means, you know, Apple or some other giant company takes a look at what you've done and clones it, and usually Apple, and therefore you go out of business because they don't give you any money.
You figure out some other product.
Right. Or what happens is you sell the product. You don't sell the company. It isn't all the employees that got bought out. It's someone buys the product and then that company wanted the product and will sustain that product.
Yeah, continues. And it may not be the same after it's been, you know, Pat changes hands, but it's still around, and you know they're continuing to update it as long as it's viable for, you know, and they're making money off it and such.
Right.
We've seen a lot of that with the web and things like that, and companies that grow up basically building something on the web, and they get bought for being, you know, for the people and for some assets. But we, like you're saying, we usually don't see that in these Mac apps. I mean, and Daniel Manton and people like Rich Siegel are perfect examples of that. It's classic Mac app people.
Right. And that's what I like when I was growing up. Like those were my heroes. Like that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be on, you know, Omni and Pink, Bare Bones, like all of those, you know, that was who I looked to for inspiration. And like, that's all the way I approached my own business. Not how do I make the most money, but how do I have a comfortable, awesome life that I can have and also do the software thing and have,
you know. That's the reason why you do it, right? I mean,
right.
Because ultimately, you saw this in the dot-com bubble where there are a whole bunch of people who were basically carpetbaggers, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They saw that there was a metric fuck ton of money. They didn't have any background in it or any of the, you know, related fields. They dove in, they tried to get their ideas made, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But usually it was to, you know, drive up a stock price and then get out. You know, it wasn't ever meant to be sustainable. Just, you know,
building companies and flipping them. And you see the exact same thing happening now. And one of the facts that I found was really interesting about Sparrow was that the investor in it tweeted what their income rate was. It was 70 to 90K a month.
Right.
Which for if it had been two guys or three guys or four guys even.
Would have been groovy.
That's perfect. Like that's fantastic. Like that's more than enough to sustain two or three or four people's salaries and have enough money left over to keep investing in the business and just have, you know, stockpile some cash in case you need to do another product or you Apple rejects your app and you can't do it anymore or whatever, right? Like that's a healthy business. But for an investor who's invested, you know, probably, I don't know how much money they got, but, you know, a significant chunk of change, like it's not a hit in like Facebook or Twitter terms, right? It wasn't pulling in millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
And I can see how like someone like that would then say, well, okay, it's not a hit, so sell.
Right? Yeah,
I
mean, exactly.
Because that's the way those, not because that's a legitimate strategy. I think that's totally BS to do stuff like that.
But that's, you know, but that's what a VC
that's their mindset.
Does.
That's the mindset.
Right. The VC is there not so that you can sustain the product that you like and love that you've created from your heart, but they're there to make money, and they're there to make as much money as humanly possible in the shortest amount of time so that they can do it again.
Right. And I mean, so, and you, in theory, knew that when you first started talking to a VC, is that that's what they do.
Exactly.
It's not bad. It's just, I mean, well, we can argue about whether or not it is, but, you know, it's not like this was a surprise to anyone that a VC would be like, okay, this is not a huge immediate return on my investment. I want you guys just to try and sell the company. Like, that's
right.
This should be pretty de rigueur, right?
Like, yeah. I mean, everyone's an adult, right? I mean, no one was tricked into signing with a VC. You seek VC funding yourself. You don't like go to a bar one day and then like stroll home in a drunken stupor and sign a bunch of papers and, you know, a giant chunk of your company away. That doesn't happen.
I seriously hope not. Like that's you have darker demons than Sparrow app if that is the case. My God.
Right. So, you know, I don't blame the Sparrow folks for doing anything that they did at all, even though there was a huge backlash. And I think two things happened there. I think there was a lot of knee-jerk reaction, I think, which is the, hey, this thing that I really liked, it's gone now. Well, technically it's not gone, and technically it's not yours, but
I also think Paul Ford essay, why wasn't I consulted?
Right, right.
It's exactly that. I mean, he puts it better, so much better than I ever could, like, because he's Paul Ford and he's amazing.
we'll definitely have that in the show notes.
I'm so jealous. He's so talented.
I do get it. I was one of the people who was a little butthurt, you know, but but I also realized why it was, you know, and I get it. If I'd have been them, I would have probably sold to Sparrow's Got to Eat. But that doesn't mean I can't feel shit upon. And it's no fault of Sparrow's. It's I'm looking at this and thinking, is this, you know, the face of things to come, where I'm used to that friendly Mac app thing like Daniel and Rich. And, you know, there's no way I'm expecting tomorrow for Bare Bones to say, hey, by the way, we just sold to Microsoft, you know, goodbye.
Right. That's the big difference between the old school Mac shareware community.
Yeah, the shareware, man.
Yeah. You exactly. know, where, right where you had, exactly. you had two things, right? You
yeah, had two so things. The sharing now is different.
Well, yeah,
we share the community, and you know, we just give them money.
Well, that was, so yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So the old shareware community was different. You had two things. You had the product, but you also had a relationship with the people who made that product. They were human beings, and they answered your emails, and you know, they didn't necessarily owe you anything, but they chose to open up to you. They chose to be more than a giant corporation like an Adobe or an Apple. And they chose to have that one-on-one communication with you. And, you know, so therefore you built a bond with another human being. You didn't build a bond with just an app.
Or a brand. You
know? Right. And so when a development company gets bought up and that product ceases to exist because the buyer is specifically not interested in sustaining the product. I mean, I'm kind of angry at Google for doing that because, hey, this was a good product. It was a viable product. And then they specifically shut it down because it's technically a competitor, you know, and that sucks.
It does. This actually makes, there's two things here and they're sort of interlinked. I feel like the App Store, both app stores, really lack a lot of the mechanisms that sustained that shareware ecosystem. Because, you know, it definitely, like any ecosystem, these things are built on processes and feedback loops and cycles, right? You know, mm-hmm. That's how these things, it's like a storm system, right? Like it oscillates in that, you know, it pushes on itself to turn itself around, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. because it's spinning, it keeps spinning. So
I like that analogy a lot, actually. I'm going to use that in the future.
Yeah.
I'd like to subscribe to your newsletter.
So obviously one of the important processes that you kind of talked about that's missing, that's a lot of people have complained about, is the lack of direct customer communication between developers and developer and customers. Because, you know, the App Store doesn't let you reply to reviews. It doesn't really give you any information about these people. It's much harder to get in touch with them. Whereas, you know, before you probably had their email address, at least if they registered the software, you did. Because they paid you. So you had all their contact info. And, you know, even going back further than that, like you may have had to send them a physical object to for them to even get the software. Like I remember, like when I was very young, buying, like we like got some stuff through the mail. Like we emailed them mailed them a blank floppy disk, and then they mailed back the unlocked version of the software to us. Like,
oh sure. Or in the old days of user groups, you'd go to, you know, the local university or the local pub or what have you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you'd share trade software. Yeah, you trade software, you trade floppies, you trade CDs, etc. Sure.
Right. And so, I mean, that's obviously missing and people have complained about that a lot. And I think that's bad. But like one thing that was very interesting about Mac software was that it was fairly high priced. Like, it was generally like $10 was the cheap price point. $20,
for shareware.
$20
right.
was the like that's the basic functional price point. Like most Mac apps were $20, and then stuff above that was not uncommon, like $50, you know, $75. I mean, so one of them is those high prices, like, and that enables a lot. Even though you have less customers, there still comes a point where if your app is well known, like you're going to be getting some baseline level of sales a week. Like, you know, the only really way to do well on the stores is to be on those lists, but there's a fixed, you know, the top 250 list, the top 100 list, the top category lists and all that stuff. But there's a fixed amount of space on those. Basically, it limits the size of the market.
Like, right. Yeah. Well, that's what Marco Arment was talking about earlier, which is, you know, originally Instapaper was like $7-$8, and then it went down and now is down to like $3. And that's because every so often he'll take a look at the App Store and say, you know, he'll find some app and look at it and be like, oh, do I really want to spend $4 on this app? And then he'll realize that, you know, his app is on the high side, even though, you know, perfectly, it totally worth the money. I mean, I get a lot of use out of his app. It's a psychological barrier. You know, if you've created an app and you've set it at a premium price, but you're looking at other apps,
you might say, you know what, but Colin, you know, you make it up in volume, and like, you know, you there's so much more of a wider reach selling on the App Store than selling it directly ever was. And that's true. There are a lot more customers. There are a ton more customers on the Mac App Store and on the iOS App Store. But the thing is, the other crucial piece that's missing is update pricing.
There's no motivation for a developer to, aside from bug fixes to make sure things don't completely crash out, there's no motivation to update an existing app. Like what you said, the second you buy the app, to the developer's perspective, you're dead weight.
Yep, exactly.
You know, unless you have like an in-app purchasing type thing. I mean, look at Apple's apps even. When was the last time they updated iWork? When was the last time they updated any of that stuff?
And that's the thing, is I think this is just, you know, having watched Apple basically my whole life, right? And like, you know, watching them through the 90s and transition into what they've become today, this situation is going to change as soon as Apple needs to really rev a lot of their apps on the store. And I think, I mean, that's got to be coming up at some point. Like, you know, you're going to need to see a new version of iLife eventually. Going to need to see a new version of iWork eventually. Like,
and somebody's going to have to pay for it, or they're not going to, you know.
Yeah. And you, if I was like, you know, a VP in, you know, iWork or iLife, you can be damn sure that I would be like, no, we need upgrade pricing for this.
But Apple's a special case, though, because Apple controls the horizontal and the vertical. So they don't need to change anything in the store in order to create new revenue for the new products. Because what they do is they stop selling. Today, they stop selling iWork 09. And then tomorrow, they start selling iWork 12. And people who bought iWork 9 are SOL. Because now 12 is the new hotness, and Apple doesn't care, much like the honey badger.
But the thing is, they have no way to reach those people with the current App Store mechanisms. You're not going to reach all of the users that way, right? You're only going to reach the people who regularly open up the app and the App Store app to look at stuff, and who regularly buy other software. You know, and you're not going to, you know, again, and like, I can see why Apple as a whole, like when you consider Apple as a whole, which a lot of people do, then you can see why they wouldn't do that. But when you sort of break it down and think about Apple as, you know, there's the iLife group and there's the iWork group and then there's the group that runs the App Store and, you know, there's the phone group and all, you know, the different fiefdoms that they have internally, you don't want to have to rely on the App Store team featuring your product, even internally, to get everybody to upgrade, right? Like, you want to be able to just reliably reach all these people and get them to upgrade. So I feel like it's got to be frustrating internally for them too, to see like this sort of dynamic playing out. And
well, I think there's a lot of developers within Apple who yeah, precisely what you say, you know, they do realize that this is kind of broken, at least for non-Apple, for everyone who isn't Apple. But I also think on a human level, they understand it. Whether or not there's enough push to actually change it, that's the big question.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think the only way it's ever going to change is someone inside Apple says, hey, we need to do this for our product. You know, says like iPhoto or iWork or, you know, like Numbers or whatever. Like if any of those are like, yeah, hey, we need update pricing, that's just something that needs to happen. It'll happen, right?
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean,
with other things where Apple is like, you know, where something's been missing from either a product or a service, and then suddenly when they need it, it shows up. I mean, it's happened on several things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just the way they work, and it's somewhat frustrating, but it also keeps them focused.
My personal favorite, I mean, Jobs used to do that all the time, right? He would always deride something as being ridiculous and silly and whatever until they got it right. Right. And so maybe that's the key.
Or until it became, you know, something that they needed to invest in to push a product forward, you know.
Right. So, like, for example, no one wants to watch a movie on a tiny screen.
Guess what? Everyone wants to watch a movie on their tiny screen.
Everyone, then.
Well, exactly. But it wasn't, it was, but the thing is, he's right. He's like Yogi Berra, right? No one wants to watch a movie on the, like, tiny screen that's on your, like, Nokia, right?
Right,
like,
right, exactly.
Right. Right.
But they do want to watch it on the 168 PPI, Retina PPI, like, you know, 300 whatever PPI, like, iPhone screen. Because it's, you know, it's much higher quality, the pixel density is much higher, the screen is much more good looking.
Well, right? that's just it. They were able to figure out how to do it right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when they do the upgrade pricing, they'll have figured out how to do it right.
So the whole thing felt weird because of what we talked about earlier with, the, you know, our experience and our relationship with the apps. I mean, personally, I started thinking about, you know, well, what if this starts happening on a regular basis with more of these Mac apps now? Which leads you down to the path, well, what if it starts to erode the trust of people too? And, they, and you know, so now you've got a great app that would get bought, but nobody buys it because they're scared to buy it. And I don't know, it's... There is a slippery slope argument, and those are always awful. I think Sparrow kind of did unleash a bit of a concern in people.
Oh, yeah.
It did for me.
Yeah, I feel like you're right. Like, there is this perception that Sparrow might be the canary. Excuse me.
In the coal mine.
Like,
yes.
Like kind of what I was talking about earlier about how, like, you know, things are changing, right? Like, this is a different – the processes at work that drive the App Store – are very different from the processes that drove the shareware market on the Mac, right? Like, just, you know, it's just a very different market. The people who buy the software is different. The way you talk to them is different. What apps are successful is different. The pricing is all different. So it's like, it's you know, that fear that what we had and what we liked is going to change. And, you know, change not necessarily for the better, but for the worse.
Well, like Colin said earlier too, you have less insight into the developer than you used to. So when you don't have this yes, no about whether a company might actively be, you know, they were there to be bought, they're, you know, that's their goal, but you don't know that. It could have been the case, it's not, but it could have been the case that, you know, that was Sparrow's goal all along. I don't believe it was. To compound that, then you have things like happen with, did you hear the thing about Madfinger Games in the Android App Store, or the Google Play Store, I guess, where they have a game called Dead Trigger that they've now made free because of the rampant piracy of it. So you have things starting to shake out in the mobile markets. And then on the flip side, yes, the Mac, the iOS App Store is better, but it's also clearly evolving. And I think Sparrow is an indication of a part of that it's changing. Well, more than that, it brings up all the things that Colin's been talking about. It brings them into light. You know, it's time to talk about them, I guess.
It seems to me, from a developer's perspective, there are two ways to go about it, right? Apple's clearly leading you down the way of, based upon their current actions within the App Store and how they've managed the whole thing, the whole ecosystem so far. The message seems to me, if you're a developer, an independent developer, you want to do freelance work for other people and create their apps, or you cannot rest on your laurels with a single app. In order to maintain a proper living for yourself and your family, you've got to continually make new, different stuff. Yeah. And hopefully maintain the other stuff, but that's not even necessary, because again, that is time that you could be spending making the new thing that will gain you more revenue because it's new, versus, you know, pouring money into something that is potentially in a market that you've saturated.
Right, exactly. And you gain no benefit from market saturation, which is it's just not a sustainable way to build a business. Apple doesn't do that. I mean, like, even in hardware, like, you know, imagine if you bought an iPod once and then you never had to buy an iPod again. You just always got iPod. Like, when they changed the iPod, you got the new one for free. That'd be terrible. Apple could never. They could never sustain that. Like, that would be insane. Like, but that's how it works. Like, that's how it works on the App Store. Like, you buy it once, you get it for free forever. Like,
yeah, it's a dichotomy of the business between you, the developer, and Apple, the hardware maker. It's like, hey, we have this great idea. We can make money off the software. We let these people sell it to sell our hardware. It's like, well, you know, that's great. However, there are there are some holes in that that are, you know, that start to show up after a while. Because the app store for you is not, you know, it's not in your corner, more or less. You know, it's there to sell Apple hardware. Sorry, I asked.
No, I'm totally 100% with you. Like, it's exactly. The app store exists to generate apps that look good in iPhone ads. Like,
yeah. You are helping to sell a product.
Yeah, you're helping to sell.
And that product iPhone. Is the hardware. Right.
Right. And that's why you don't get a free iPod, because you're there to sell iPods.
Right. Exactly.
And yeah, you're there to make vendor lock-in compelling.
Right.
You know, this is very much, you know, the Matrix, where you discover that you're actually a battery.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for sure.
All the developers are actually batteries for Apple. You know, and that's a really that imagery just really creeped me out.
Good.
Yeah.
Then the thing is, be creeped out and then do something about it. You know what I mean?
Well, like, right. You know, and or at least developers have to realize that that is what they are and be cool with it and work within that system, or they GTFO, right? They
STFO, they stay the hell out.
Right. Well, you know, because Mac development, you know, doesn't require the Mac App Store. You know, you can still sell it on the side. As a matter of fact, even with Mountain Lion, you know, you can make non-sandboxed apps. And there are a lot of apps out there that would never be able to be sold on the Mac App Store because it violates the terms to be sold in the Mac App Store.
Right.
BBEdit, for example, has actually forked its binary. The version that you get on the Mac App Store is different than the one that you get directly from them. And luckily, they kind of figured it out, where you can just download all the pieces parts that are missing from the initial install. It's not the same thing, you know. The whole point of the Mac App Store is that it's simple. You know, you kind of click once and you forget about it, and it's automatically updated, and life is groovy.
And if you need to delete it, it doesn't leave all this trash all over your system. Like, it's, you know,
users soon will not be used to manually dealing with applications, and maybe they shouldn't. You know, maybe it doesn't matter. You know, maybe, you know, I like to tinker with my cars, so, you know, I'm always, I'll you know, put in a different transmission, a different rims and suspension and all that other stuff, but that's me. You know, I'm one in 250,000, let's say, for sake of argument. You know, yeah. I'm a rounding error. Right. So the better overall experience is certainly the Mac App Store from the perspective of the user. You know, they see stuff, their credit card is already there, so it's a totally seamless transaction. They click the shiny thing that they want, and suddenly it's on their system and life is beautiful. But if you want real apps that do real things, that talk to other real apps, then you've got a problem coming down the line, because going to be fewer and far between.
This was always one of the big problems with Mac software development, was it's really hard to get and install and keep apps. Like, it's a pain in the butt. Remember the several year long tiff about how best to package an app, you know, disk image versus zip versus internet enabled disk image versus installers versus that was a debate that went on for years and was very heated, and people were very opinionated and very angry about a lot of it. And I think that speaks to how hard it was to get people to download, install, and use Mac apps. It was very difficult up until the Mac App Store came out. Well, until the iOS App Store, actually, because then people were like, oh shit, apps are a thing. I can get apps for my computer. Right. Like, I wonder if I can get apps for my Mac as well. And because this is sort of bringing me back to something that I was talking about before with when I was at Mozilla. It was a very interesting time because it was 2007 and iPhone was out, but it was pre-App Store.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. And so that was a really interesting time to be there, because you really saw sort of the Rococo period of the web versus native app debate. Because the mobile was a thing that was really coming into focus as this was going to be the next big thing. Even once the iPhone was announced and came out and everything, people were like, whoa, this mobile thing, this is important. this is clearly going somewhere. And, you know, there was this very sharp debate about, you know, do you want a web app or do you want a native app? And, you know, JSON had just really started to come into its own. And like, there was still a lot of the old semantic web people doing stuff. And then, you know, there were micro formats. There was a lot of stuff happening in this web versus native space. And, you know, like at the time, like, I think myself and a lot of people really felt like the web had the greater velocity and had, you know, really was the one that looked like it had a future. Like if you compared it to like, you know, the state of getting a Mac app in 2007, like it was a pain in the butt. It felt old and crusty. Like it wasn't as nice an experience as going somewhere in your web browser and like signing up for an account and like having everything synced everywhere, like automatically. Like sync really didn't exist. Like Dropbox didn't exist. Like none of this stuff was really that common in 2007.
But at the same time, with the web stuff, though, everything was kind of janky. It didn't really look like a real app. And well, the actual functionality, it was all just app, a front-end to a database. Something else.
We didn't know. Now when we say app, it's kind of a different thing.
App, that's Angry Birds, right?
Right, right. And people are moving Instagram more towards app because we've kind of changed our thinking on all this. And I agree. Early on, it's like, well, okay, the web stuff it's you can do anything on the web, more or less. But now we see people, you know, apps are becoming something that we move around. You have an app here and there, you know, I don't know. It's
right. Yeah, exactly. Like that's really what changed. Like, you know, in 2007, it was very much like, it was sort of like, well, okay, well, the web can easily fill in these gaps that like you can't do on the web yet. But you will be able to because, you know, for the browser manufacturers were really starting to move quicker, like Chrome just come out. The browser market was heating up again, like, right. You know, and so it looked like that was, you know, going to be where there's all this attention and energy was going to happen. Like
what was the promise there of Java,
and then
right?
App stuff just blew up out of nowhere. Like, you know, the iOS App Store came out and I think no one, not even Apple, really understood just how big of a deal this was going
to
be.
They're this tiny thing that you feel, you know, you're attached to maybe, but it's something that's eventually probably disposable, except for, you know, certain things that you keep on or you find something similar. So it was a very different sort of way to approach your programs or what we used to call, you know, applications. But apps are little things in a way.
They're popcorn. Right. But the other thing was that it became very, very clear to everyone involved once they got their original iPhones, which I have on my desk right here, because that's still my carry phone. When the iPhone first came out, Steve was like, yeah, you can make web apps. And people did. People said, wow, this thing is really, really cool. I'm going to make a web app and it's going to work really well on iOS. And what happened? Well, you realize that the JavaScript interpreters and the HTML interpreters were really kind of slow, even on that phone. I mean, the fact that it could do it at all is kind of magical, right?
Like, yeah.
But you took a look at the native apps on the device and how fluid they were and how fast they were. This is actually the release version as opposed to the preview version. Because remember, they previewed the iPhone like 6 to 8 months prior to it being actually available.
Right,
and during that preview,
because basically they would have to start doing FCC testing and it would have come out anyway. So
right, exactly. And so you may as well control that message, right? So right. One of the things that they did was they actually had a bunch of those original apps were actually HTML-based apps.
Yep.
The problem is that the performance on those apps were really poor in comparison to the native apps. And so the developers saw this and said, well, hell, why are we stuck in second-class loserville? These janky, well, we can kind of make widgets that look like the buttons on iOS. And it's not going to feel as good. It's not going to look as good. It's not going to be as fast, but it'll get there. And that's when they said, screw this. We want native applications. That's why the jailbreak community from the beginning was so huge. Because before the App Store existed, they were able to get apps, like native apps, onto the device.
Right.
They were few and far between.
And the hardware was not like PCs where the processing power just goes up and up and up and up and up and up. You've got people looking at this device saying, well, I'm trapped by the power of this browser to start with. So someone like Colin can write, say, well, I could write this code and it would be so much faster to run natively. And we're looking at these smaller devices who are getting, you know, they are getting faster, they are getting more memory, but you're still, you know, there is a gating effect there, are, you know, built in. So having native apps was the way to make that experience better.
Right. And I mean, I think Apple saw very quickly that that was, they needed to let that happen because these,
right.
They were just not, I mean, come on, like they were awful. Yeah. The experience was horrible. Like fun fact about the browser on like the early iOS, like mm-hmm. iOS 1 and iOS 2,
yep.
Performance on page, like loading a page, like page load performance, not network bound. It was CPU bound.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like freaking rendering a, like loading a page, not network bound, was CPU bound. Like if you tethered, like you, because remember you could get like this sort of Stamets dot tethering, like on the original iPhone, like mm-hmm. sort of before, like they really locked that down.
Oh yeah.
AT&T. That was, the internet was so much faster tethering than it was doing it in the browser, because it was just like, it wasn't, you're using a computer with so much more processing power to render the page.
It was orders of magnitude. So yeah, the benchmarks were orders of magnitude slower than your typical desktop. And I'm not talking about like the high end, you know, multiprocessor Mac
like
Pro.
IMac.
I'm talking
like an iMac, yeah. Or like a.
But
like
then you throw a, you know, some web app into that too, which is now CPU bound and network contention bound. You know, you've just made something the performance of which can only be so good.
Right. Yep. I mean, the original iPhone had 128 megs of memory. The actual free memory was something like 8 megs.
Yeah, which you is had kind of crazy. Apps generally were given 60 megs for the before the Watchdog process would kill them. But you know that includes. You know, like that would vary depending on what else was going on in the system. And, you know, Mobile Safari would like, you know, it would constantly page out those tabs like all the time. Yeah.
You could not load a, at the time, modern web page, you know, unless it was the most simple of pages, you would wind up paging out. You know, if you created a new tab, you just page out instantaneously. I mean, there was all loading all the time. As a matter of fact, you would even do it intra-page.
Right, and when tabbed browsing came along, it was even more obvious because, you know, you would load a page and then you would flip back to a tab and it would have to completely reload the page and everything else would be either be stalled or, you know, it was, not good times.
It's about the software. Like, the second an iOS device becomes not able to use the latest software upgrade. Like, because, like, I want the latest, all the improvements. Like Mail has gotten so much better over the course of the – it's gotten a ton better. Like, Mail on the iPad is, like
– Oh, Mail on the iPad's beautiful. I've got a third-generation iPad with LTE, and holy living fuck, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, the Retina display on the iPad is phenomenal. The LTE in my area my area being when I actually go into Manhattan, because LTE is not anywhere near here.
you're in Connecticut, right?
Yeah, I'm in Greenwich, Connecticut.
I was there for, I was just visiting my friend Philip. We can talk about that more later because I need to mention Philip and Patrick and my podcast that I do with them.
You'd figure Greenwich would have like the newest, shiniest, most expensive thing, but... Clearly, it doesn't.
NIMBYs, man. NIMBYs. They don't want to build. They don't want another cell tower built because it's going to get.
Well, that's the other thing
cancer.
Too. Yeah, I have zero. I basically have zero balls at my house.
That's rough.
I've got like one ball, like the lowest of the saddest.
So,
ball.
Can you get texts? Like,
yeah. As a matter of fact, I can. Yeah, texting is the easiest way to contact me when I'm in my house or via iMessage. Because my iPad is my primary messaging device.
Makes sense since it's very new.
Right. You know, and everyone I know has iPhones anyway, so it's all free. You know, because everyone's basically dropped their text plans because everyone they know has iPhones as well. You know, it's a nice portable way to converse with everyone you want. I use it more like instant message than SMS.
Yeah.
So I was FaceTiming with my friend Troy, who lives in Seattle, whom I'm going to see tomorrow. His internet, his Fios connection was down. And was down for like a week. And that was his only connection to the internet aside from 3G/4G service, right? So I FaceTimed him. He was on his internal network. So his Wi-Fi was enabled, right? But the Wi-Fi couldn't get out into the internet because the Fios connection was down.
Right.
So I FaceTimed him. I tried to FaceTime him to his computer. The computer never brought up the incoming message because, of course, it had no internet connection.
Right.
His phone, however, picked up the ring. And guess what wound up happening was he was very clearly FaceTiming over cellular. And we tested this by having him walk all the way down to the gym half a mile away.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah, so there's a little backdoor secret. This is hypothesis, and I need further testing. So folks at home, test this out. If you have Wi-Fi enabled and your phone is picking up the Wi-Fi signal, but it cannot get out into the internet, it's going to use your cellular data as a backup to get out into the internet.
Right.
And I think that tricked. There's clearly a bug in the current OS.
It's almost certainly a bug. Like, it is.
It's decidedly not a feature.
That,
well, it's a feature for
it's
me.
It's got the right sort of confluence of like circumstances that it's like Wi-Fi seems to be on, but we're getting this thing coming over 3G, and like, are we on the internet? Like, I don't really know.
And it wasn't just a one-time event. We were able to consistently do it because this internet was out for like a week.
That's crazy.
Of course, I'm really looking forward to living in South Korea land where everyone's getting gigabit to their house for $30 a month.
The internet in this country is so backwards. It's so terrible.
It's so bizarre. And, on the plus side, some of the more rural areas are beginning to have municipal fiber. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about is you've got your own show.
Yes. Yeah, we have. It's me, my friend Philip Bowden, and our friend Patrick Thompson. It's a little bit like this show, or like Roderick on the Line. It's not as tech heavy as some of the other, like, you know, like Mule Radio or 5x5 shows.
You mean
like,
you don't talk about coffee or BMWs?
It's about, you know, about technology, sure, but, you know, also rap music, movies, comics, and, you know, just sort of like what it's like to be a 20-something in sort of the crumbling American empire. And like, we talk a lot about memories of growing up. We're all around the same age, where I'm 26 and the other two guys are a little bit younger than me.
I am so old.
So, but it's a cool show. I really like what we're doing with it. We've got some really great episodes that are coming out, and it's just a lot of fun to talk to them and listen to what they've got to say. And it's cool to make things. It's really cool to make things.
Oh, hell yeah.
We're all very earnest. The three of us are all very earnest. It's a lot of us saying, you know what? That was cool. Like, I'm pretty sure we're going to talk at length about that Spider-Man cartoon, for example, on our next episode.
Because I listened to the most recent episode, and I think you talked a little bit about it.
We may have. It's entirely possible.
Yeah, you guys went through a whole bunch of subjects as well. It was a very intimate kind of like few people hanging around talking, drinking beers.
Exactly. That's exactly sort of the feel that we have. Like, time's gone by and stuff like that.
Yeah, you need a house band. You could be the house band.
Yeah, we're kind of like the Roots.
Totally.
Yeah. And I think we're going to try and, I was just talking about this with Patrick. We're going to try and get some guests on there. And like, you know, like just some cool people that we know that like are funny and like have interesting stuff to talk about, or like a different perspective on some of the stuff that we like to talk about. Like, I think one of the people I want to get on is my friend, Zach Dreher. I mean, he's all three of us know him very well. And he works at this company called Twitch TV. Justin TV. And what's really interesting about them is that they are by far the market leader in esports video streaming. And if you're not familiar with esports, it's basically competitive video games. So like StarCraft 2. There is such a cool community around StarCraft 2. It's really interesting. And then what's crazy is because of a licensing issue between Blizzard and the Korean Pro Esports League, most Korean pros actually have stayed on Brood War, which is the first, you know, the update to StarCraft 1.
Wow.
StarCraft Brood War. For even after StarCraft 2 was released. So, and they're only really now, I think it's like next season is when they're starting to play StarCraft 2. Because basically Blizzard was like, hey, if you want to play StarCraft, you need to give us a cut. And KESPA, the Korean Esports Professionals Association, was like, fuck that. You're not getting shit. And so they've you know, been in this very long, you know, protracted public fight about coming to terms with all this stuff. And they finally reached an agreement. So yeah, Zach knows a lot about StarCraft 2. And like, it's a really cool community. And it's like, because of the fact that the Korean scene was not involved in it, there's a lot more Western involvement in StarCraft 2. They're called foreigners. Foreigner community is much stronger in StarCraft 2 than it was in StarCraft 1. And so, like, you know, there are major tournaments that happen in the U.S. actually, like, fairly regularly. It's a really cool scene. Like, it's really exciting. You wouldn't think that watching someone play a video game would be exciting, but these guys are really good, and they're like athletes in the same way that chess players are athletes. Like, it is very difficult to sit there and play this game, like, just mentally and physically. Like, you're stressed out, the adrenalines are going, like, you need stamina, like, you need to work on that, like, you need to train.
Sure.
I mean, anyone who was in chess club and played chess at any sort of level, like, competitively, knows that you feel drained after it, you know, after going to a meet, like, you're, like, exhausted.
Where can we find you? Where can we find
you
it?
Can, If you Google postmodem and then my name, it's like it comes up. We don't have our website up quite yet. We're in iTunes. All that stuff. We have a you can get us our Twitter account, which is postmodemcast, postmodemcast, and we post updates there when we post new episodes and we retweet things that are related to upcoming episodes and stuff like that we're doing. Wait, but we're working like literally right now on a website for it. I spent yesterday writing Ruby and HTML and oh god
my condolences.
It has been a long time, but it's all very similar
very
to
cool.
the way it used to be.
We're definitely going to have you on again because there's so much I would like to continue talking to you about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like there's so much stuff on that list that of show notes that you sent over that we didn't even
that's perfectly
come close
normal.
To touching.
That is so par for the course. And that's the fun bit because, guests that we really like, we get to have back. So where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is cbarrett and my blog that I update somewhat regularly, maybe 10 times a year or something like that, is I Am the Walrus, all one word with the .us as the domain name. It's a little domain hack I bought many years ago and just liked it enough to use it as my personal blog. And I write about like stuff like that. I also write this link blog with my friend Illy Butterfield. It's called Nulla Resources, and it's like interesting links and music and videos and like images and stuff. It's on Tumblr and it's Nulla Resources, NULLARY sources. And that's really, I really love that. That's so much fun to do because it's just sort of like tracking all the crazy crap that both of us come across on the internet. And we've been actually best buddies since we were like 7 years old or so. So we have this sort of like cool mind meld going on. We have this, we have a lot of very, very similar tastes in music, but he's actually very interesting, my friend Illy, because he is one of the people who was a judge on that site, OC Remix. Have you ever heard of Overclocked Remix? He's one of the people who makes that happen. He also runs this site called involved in the running of the site called the VGMDB.
I believe
he's involved in that, which is sort of a like, it's like IMDb for video games and catalogs all the different releases and the soundtracks and all that stuff. Nice. He's a cool guy and I have a ton of fun doing that blog with him.
I've been a huge fan of your Nori Sources for a while and I didn't realize it wasn't just you.
It's me. We gotta figure out how to like get that. Either we gotta ditch Tumblr or figure out how to get Tumblr to like play better because it's like really
Tumblr's
constantly
a mess.
Like editing anything in the UI is just like, I don't mean to grouse about it because it's free and it's served us well. You go in there and you're like, okay, I just want to edit this post, and then you go out and then like the automatically like it blanks out like a ton of the fields that you had filled in before because you hit save, and it's like, why are you clearing out the message that I wanted you to post to Twitter and the tags? Like, why did those just get deleted? And then it'll like just fail to publish posts. Like we'll say, all right, we want this post to get published at 10 a.m. on Wednesday.
Or not.
10 a.m. on Wednesday rolls around, nothing happens. It's still sitting there days later.
You didn't specify which Wednesday.
Your only purpose is to publish blog posts. Like, how do you not get that right? Like,
I blame Marco's leaving.
The whole purpose of the site is to put blog posts onto the internet, and you're fucking it up. Like, come on.
Oh, yeah. No, I find Tumblr to be... it's interesting because... you're one of the, or at least seemingly one of the few people who actually post original material onto Tumblr. Every other Tumblr blog that I come across is pirated material.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just a mess of reblogs.
Yeah,
and like,
the whole idea of any sort of original attribution is completely just burnt, like wholly. And it's so ridiculous. As someone who creates original content, I find those types of services that make it so easy to just up and plop whatever the hell exists on another site onto your own site to be an anathema to the web.
Yeah, I found this awesome picture the other day, and it was on a Tumblr. So I ended up having to use the Google image search to try to find the original because it was on like three Tumblrs. It wasn't attributed on any of them.
I looked to John Gruber as my like model for attribution. Like that guy is so consistent about sending both traffic and like just mind share to the people who are responsible for creating the content. Yeah. Like
And
one of the things that he gets right that I really love is that he gets right when someone works at a publication versus just freelance writing for them.
Because you're a hired gun, It's like you don't have any more association with them at all. I mean, he very rarely screws that up. And when he does, he's super quick to correct it too, which is really, really good on him.
I don't know. It's like he wouldn't want someone screwing up his thing. Like, if he wrote a piece for Macworld, they wouldn't want to say, like, John Gruber, writer at Macworld. Like, he wouldn't want that, right?
I heard someone on a different podcast, you know, he was trying to attribute story to a writer, and he was on the Huffington Post, and I'm sitting there screaming, you know, it's not attributed because they scraped it off a website. Exactly. You know, there's no writer.
Yeah, there's someone who re-edits, so it's slightly different.
Right, exactly. I hate that.
Yeah, the rewriting is awful. It's totally unethical. Like, look, be real. If you did that in college, if you rewrote someone else's paper, you would get kicked out for plagiarism.
Easily.
Like, that's the like the litmus test, right? If you did this with a college paper, would you get in trouble?
Right.
All right. Like, this is not that hard. Like, but there's a lot of people who defend that. They're like, oh, or he's creating his own version of the article. I'm like, no,
that's not how that works. That's not how that works.
Talk to any of these people. He's just copy pasting the quotes, messing up what is in quotes and what isn't oftentimes.
Right.
Which is misleading.
It's the internet equivalent of the old guy sitting on the porch reading the newspaper to his friends, but reading it poorly.
So bad. Yeah. So bad. So, Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL or at about.me/MaggieMcPhee. And where can we find you, Christopher?
Oh, you can find me in a very dark cave. No, you can find me on the Twitters at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe. And that's pretty much it these days. My moribund blog is indeed moribund. One day I'll breathe new life into it, but not as of yet. So thank you again, Colin, for joining us, and we would love to have you back to continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Just let me know when.
Cheers.
Awesome.
Yay.
Bye.
Bye. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts, Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.